Welcome to Interdependent Study, our podcast where we engage in the learning and unlearning work for collective liberation. I'm Damien.
And I'm Aaron. Thank you so much for joining us today. Each week, we'll bring something new to the table and discuss our thoughts and feelings about it through the lenses of who we are and where we can go for a more just society.
That's right. We want Interdependent Study to be a space where we're always learning with one another. Mm-hmm. And Aaron, you're up this week. Mm-hmm. What have you brought to the table today?
Well, I've got an article from In These Times for us today.
Great.
It is called The War on Protest and was written by Adam Federman. This article is really, really well done, and you could use it for the outline of a dystopian novel that some people might call far-fetched.
Wow.
because that is what's happening in the country.
Uh-huh.
So he goes on to talk about the ways that several states have adopted laws that make civil disobedience and protesting basically terrorism, how they conflate the two. The article talks about the Stop Cop City movement happening in Atlanta and how Georgia has cracked down on the organizers in that movement via anti-terrorism laws that were passed in Georgia a few years back. Mm-hmm. In addition to Georgia, these kinds of laws have been passed in 21 other states that create harsher penalties for common charges for protesters like trespassing and blocking highways. One of the statistics that is referenced early on in the article is from the International Center for Not-for-Profit Law, where they found that 300 laws have been introduced in state legislatures since 2017 that would restrict protest in some way. So this is something that's happening across the country.
Yes.
And it's something that's really alarming, I think. And
yes.
So, I'm glad to have this article here to understand it a bit better from this month's edition of In These Times magazine, their cover story, I believe.
Yeah, it is.
So, yeah, it's really great and also dystopian and makes me think, what would we call it if this was happening in some other country that we like to be really critical of in
That's
the United States?
Great like, question.
You know, if this was China, what would we call it? Mm-hmm. If this was North Korea, what would we call it?
Yes.
Just things to think about.
Uh-huh. You know? Just throwing that out there.
Yeah. Uh-huh. What did you think about it?
Yeah, I agree. This was a fantastic and, I mean, honestly, truly timely piece for us, given the crazy world in which we're living right now. You know, we're witnessing this rise in the number of protests taking place across the country, but especially on college campuses, which is near and dear to my heart since that's where we work. And, you know, college students are calling for ceasefire in Gaza. They're demanding divestment from Israel at their institutions and sort of more broadly than that, which, you know, I'm all for. And so I think that makes all of the analysis in this piece incredibly helpful and relevant.
Yeah.
And so, I'm excited to talk about this one today. One of the biggest things that stood out to me is what Federman highlights as the targeting of protesters and social movements, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how that's not a new thing that's happening by any means, but it's evolved over the years, if you will.
Yeah.
And so you started to mention this, the recent Cop City arrest in Atlanta. You know, he shares this great quote about, as you say, how Georgia has expanded its domestic terrorism law and 21 states passed similar legislation to enhance penalties and fines for common protest activity.
Yep.
As you say, trespassing, blocking highways. And so he quotes Nick Robinson, who's a senior legal advisor at the International Center for Nonprofit Law. And Nick says, quote, "We're in a really unique moment with the amount of legislation that we're seeing with this legal assault on protesters and the right to protest in the United States."
Mm-hmm.
And as you mentioned here, there's been 300 anti-protest bills in the state legislature since 2017, and 41 of them have passed.
Mm-hmm.
And so that to me is very scary and really should be shocking to all of us. One of the things he goes on a little bit later to say, quote, "Among recently passed state laws, 19 enhance penalties for or make it a felony to engage in protest on or near energy infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
A clear reaction to the mass protests over the Dakota Access Pipeline at Standing Rock in 2016.
Yep.
After 2020's Black Lives Matter protests, 5 states enacted laws and 9 others have pending legislation that impose harsh penalties for individuals who block traffic or even sidewalks. Some states added laws granting immunity to drivers who strike protesters and extending liability for crimes committed during protests to any organizations that support them."
Mm-hmm.
This January, in response to growing opposition to the war in Gaza, Democrats in New York proposed a bill that would expand the definition of domestic terrorism to include blocking public roads or bridges.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think what this analysis offers us as readers is that over time, the persecution of folks engaged in social movements has not just been a continuous thing, but it's intensified. And I think that's important for all of us to recognize and something for us to be incredibly concerned about.
Yeah, definitely. And I think I want to talk about the so-called liberal states that are mentioned in this article. You already started talking about New York there. They're mentioned, obviously, and so is Oregon.
Yes.
They're both considered progressive states, but the way that they want to crack down on protesting speaks volumes to who they actually are.
Yes.
So here's the elected leaders who are supposed to be saving us from fascism if we just vote for them one more time. So in New York, like you said, expand definition of domestic terrorism to include blocking public roads or bridges. And in Oregon, they passed a law in August 2023 that defines critical infrastructure as public roads, meaning protest activity that damages a highway could be prosecuted as domestic terrorism. What constitutes damage, Oregon statute doesn't say, exemplifying how vaguely written laws open the door to potential abuse.
Yes.
There's a lot in there. This really, I think, points out how liberals are the people who support these protest movements when they're from the past, but they want us to believe that the protesters of today go too far or ask for too much. They want all of this to fit into neat little boxes of how they think the civil rights movement worked.
That's right.
Which is unrealistic for a bunch of reasons. The first being they have a deliberate misunderstanding of how it all worked, because to modern day liberals, they just think that the March on Washington fixed it all.
Yes.
But that was one day, one moment of a movement that was obviously influential, but it was a huge pre-planned and permitted event.
Yes.
Organizers and activists also spent years staging demonstrations at segregated lunch counters and boycotted segregation on city buses in Montgomery, none of which was civil. It was all nonviolent.
Right.
But it wasn't civil. And they would be called terrorism now.
Yes.
Because blocking a road is terrorism.
It's terrorism, apparently.
So then blocking a lunch counter and preventing white people from accessing a lunch counter that's only meant for them would also be considered terrorism, 100%. Right? So these weren't nice little protests, and they were contentious.
Yes.
And we just think because, you know, we have this vision or version of Dr. King and other leaders of the Southern Freedom Movement who have become Disney characters in our minds. They're these orderly people who asked for changes politely as if Jim Crow was just going to go away and say, oh, shucks, I'm awfully sorry about that, folks. It's like, it's just ridiculous.
It is.
And the other piece that it makes me think about is how even when we're in favor of something that is part of the criminal punishment system, we have to be very careful about what it all means and what power it gives to the criminal punishment system, because it can always come back on the rest of us.
Absolutely.
And so when all this anti-terrorism stuff was happening, you know, following 9/11, there wasn't a lot of opposition to it in the public sphere. There were lots of people who were on the streets protesting against stuff like this, like the Patriot Act and whatever.
Right.
But generally, it was just like, well, yeah, that's targeting the people who did the thing. Blah, blah. Like, but obviously, it can all be turned around. We can all redefine how the machine works to apply to the people who want to target, who we want the machine to target today. And this is just another element of that piece that I think is important to keep in mind as we think about how this stuff morphs over time.
I agree. I think that's really great analysis. And you talk about how it's so unrealistic to put this protest and these movements into neat boxes for so many reasons. And, you know, that statement made me think about just the fact that we're witnessing assaults on our democracy, assaults on our lives at every angle, in every way possible. And so you're absolutely right. Our thoughts, our energy, our protest against that is not pretty, cannot be pretty because of that. Mm. They are absolutely assaulting anyone at every point.
Yeah, it's not these little sanitized visions and versions of things that they have. And I think the line right now is that the assault on democracy were all the people on January 6th, which I'm not downplaying, that's an assault on democracy, but also all these people who are elected into office officially are also assaulting democracy in some way and shape and form. So let's not lose sight of the whole picture. let's keep our eyes on those folks who stormed the Capitol on the 6th, but also what's your legislator doing?
Mm-hmm.
You know, say calling blocking a road domestic terrorism is absolutely ludicrous.
It's absurd.
It's bonkers.
Yes.
And let's not lose sight of what these authoritarians who have a little Democratic Party and a blue donkey next to them are also doing in these state legislatures across the country.
Absolutely. That's a very good point that he brings up in this piece. And so mm-hmm. I appreciate that. You talk about these legislators, and one of the things that stood out to me in this piece that I also wanted to bring up was how it's important that we recognize the rhetoric that's being used by everyone, as you mentioned, but especially by the right wing in perpetuation of these attacks.
Yeah.
So Fetterman has this great quote that I wanted to share. He says, quote, accompanying these laws is increasingly harsh rhetoric from political figures to demonize protest movements, characterizing activists as rioters, mobs, violent extremists, and terrorists. Mm-hmm. Protesters face other threats too. During the summer of racial justice protests that followed the police killing of George Floyd in 2020, the Trump administration openly discussed deploying military force to clear demonstrations, and protesters in Portland, Oregon were snatched from the street by federal law enforcement officials in unmarked vehicles, a troubling episode still shrouded in mystery. Mm-hmm. More recently, pro-Palestinian activists said they've faced home visits from police and the FBI. This week, Senator Tom Cotton urged people who end up stuck in traffic due to protest actions to take matters into your own hands and put an end to this nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is a great piece of this analysis. And we've talked about this idea of rhetoric before in a previous episode or two. But for me, it's hard not to overstate how incredibly dangerous it is in the context of and in response to our social movements and folks engaged in peaceful protests of our government's wrongdoings or police brutality and so much more. And it's also very dangerous and harmful when it incites violence in response to peaceful protests, like what Tom Cotton was calling for in that quote.
Yeah, and I think Tom Cotton's calling for vigilante violence.
Yes.
And, you know, that's one element of this. And there's so many other pieces of it, because there's other people who are calling, I think Mike Johnson maybe, I don't remember who, a few people have said this. We need the National Guard to come in and clear these places out. The National Guard already has a history of killing college students on college campuses.
Yep.
And so we want to bring them in again.
We want to do this again?
Yeah. That's what we want.
Mm.
Okay. That's what you want to go on the record of saying that.
Apparently
that's what we want to do?
Yeah.
All right, great. So just more stuff to keep in mind about the rhetoric of all of this and who's saying what and what that actually means.
Absolutely.
Because they've got short memories. Mm-hmm. But let's talk about college campuses a little bit.
Okay.
This was written a little bit before the moment we find ourselves in, where there are many, many sustained protests across college campuses that demand divestment from companies that are war profiteers and or making money on the Israeli occupation and genocide in Gaza. But the article talks about institutions cracking down on student organizations that serve a specific purpose of educating their peers about and creating opposition to the Israeli occupation. So the state of Florida shut down all of their Students for Justice in Palestine organizations at one point across all of the state universities because they allegedly provide material support for terrorist organizations. This has been challenged by the ACLU in court. But Brandeis, Columbia, and George Washington University, all private institutions, are all mentioned in the article as making decisions that limit the activities of organizations like SJP or suspend them outright.
Absolutely.
So we're seeing these so-called liberal institutions that, again, are private, continue to coalesce around capital, around their endowment and the money that they get to make from their endowment, and protecting the value of that endowment in terms of the bottom dollar.
Yes.
And so they're falling into the trap I mentioned earlier about liberals who support the protests of yore but can't handle the ones in the current day. Many of these institutions have pages on their websites decrying the actions of the past administrations that they're now repeating on their students. So the hypocrisy of it all is, I think, infuriating when you take all of these things all together. It's just a nice little stew of rage that I think I've been simmering.
Yes, you have been. Well, I was going to share if it's okay. You know, we talked about this a little bit, and that notion of institutions, what bothers me so deeply to my core as an educator is when you don't live your values, when you don't live them fully. And so these institutions that have pages on their websites about their values, we know what goes into making those kinds of value statements. We know that there are so many stakeholders involved. We know that it takes months to think about and figure out who you are as an institution and what's important to you to put that out. And there's institutional buy-in to that. So then to just live in and employ tactics that are fully against that, it's so infuriating. It's so sad.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Here we are. One of the things that this conversation and this piece make me worried about is the election this year.
I guess that's happening.
Right? Remember that that thing is happening this year. And while unfortunately I think both of our options aren't the best, the possibility of four more years of Trump is something that legit scares the hell out of me, especially in the context of our rights and our freedoms. And Fetterman says a lot about this in this piece, but one of the quotes I wanted to share was this, quote, "Should Trump win, as he well might, he has already vowed to pursue his enemies with a vengeance and serve as a dictator for at least day one. On the campaign trail, Trump has lamented not having sent troops to quell protests during the summer of 2020 and has said he'd consider suspending the Constitution to further his agenda. Meanwhile, his far-right allies have reportedly drafted plans to invoke the Insurrection Act, allowing Trump to use military force to crush opposition movements and civil unrest, making mass action like the Women's March all but impossible." And, you know, I know that man likes to hear the sound of his own voice and is so erratic with his thoughts and his behavior. But, if he were to be elected, I'm really worried and scared about what he will be able to do, what he'll set out to do, especially armed with right-wing legislators, a stacked Supreme Court, just the mindset that a lot of our country is in. I'm worried.
I don't know what to do. I'm not sure what to do about it, because the Democrats aren't doing anything to win themselves the election on their own. They want us to believe that this is they have to win because this is going to be worse, and it could be worse, but worse for who is also a question. I don't know, man.
We don't have solutions here.
We don't have solutions, just frustrations. That's all we got. That's what we're airing today.
Absolutely.
Welcome to the podcast.
Yeah.
Hey there, folks. Sorry for the interruption, but we wanted to invite you to join us over on Patreon.
Yeah, we're so excited to be on Patreon and be able to create some additional content and opportunities for us to learn and unlearn together.
That's right. We'll be rolling out some new ways you can join us in our collective learning and unlearning over the next few weeks.
So you can join for free and get some regular updates from us. And we'll also have paid tiers available as well, with extra content available each month.
You can find us at patreon.com/interdependent study. And join us today.
That's right. You can join right now at patreon.com/interdependent study. Okay, now back to the episode.
patreon.com/interdependent study. Well, let's talk about applications. Feels like a good time to shift and talk about application, because what else is application other than the election?
That's right.
How does this article apply to our day-to-day lives? My application for this week is about how our rights are being encroached upon.
Yes.
And we have to understand what this means for us individually, based on our own state laws or maybe local laws, how hostile they are to freedom of speech or assembly, and the kind of civil disobedience that has traditionally been a part of protest movements in this country.
Yes.
Like trespassing, for example. And I want to think about, how are we defending ourselves against charges of terrorism because we donated to a bail fund for people who are arrested at a demonstration that is in opposition to Israel's genocide and occupation, like is what might be happening to some folks? Or how do we avoid facing charges originally meant for organized crime, like what happened in Atlanta with the Stop Cop City movement? How are we preparing ourselves for these kinds of charges, these trumped up, for lack of a better word, charges? As we engage in organizing, how are we pushing back against these laws that are being passed? Not to mention that this will apply to more than just the people who are actively out in the streets, because as I mentioned earlier, and we can see a few examples in this article, laws like this have an original intent or an original sort of target for people.
Yes.
And then they get expanded to include more targets. That's and right. using anti-terrorism legislation to control and punish anti-genocide organizers because they blocked a road is obviously beyond the original intent of what people meant about anti-terrorism legislation in the late 90s and early, you know, aught decade.
Yes.
So, yeah, that's my application for this week. How about you?
Yeah, I think our application is really similar here, and I love your questions that you ask. I think those are really great questions to for all of us to consider. This piece really made me think about all that we're seeing with the broadening of what is unlawful as it relates to protests and social movements and, you know, the striking down of that right to protest by the Supreme Court, the boldness of the rhetoric we're seeing in this country, and all of that was summed up pretty well with this quote that Fetterman says. He says, taken together, says Charlie Hogle, a staff attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union's National Security Project, these shifts will inevitably have a chilling effect on the sort of important political speech we think the First Amendment is intended to protect. And I think that's so true, and it's an imperative, and it's something we all need to be incredibly concerned about. And as you mentioned, if we don't fight these shifts, as he calls it, this authoritarian infringement on our rights, I'm worried about the impact of that. I'm worried about what it will mean for our country. I'm worried about what it ultimately will mean for all of us as citizens. And so I think we've got to be sounding the alarm about this. Our fight, our social movements have to continue in order to make sure that this doesn't happen. But I also think all of those questions that you ask are great things for us to consider and think about and to figure out what our stance is, to figure out how we're working in community and solidarity with one another, to fight the fight at at every juncture.
Yeah, you're right. Let's talk about homework. How are we going to continue to learn about this beyond our conversation today? So there's a PEN America report that's mentioned in the article called Arresting Dissent, Legislative Restrictions on the Right to Protest,
right,
that I think would be interesting to read so I could learn a bit more about how all this is occurring and the kinds of suggestions that PEN America has for addressing this issue.
Yes.
Beyond airing my frustrations with my friend on a podcast
yes.
episode. So that's, I think that's my homework. I'm going to try to read that at some point in the near future.
Absolutely. I love that. I mean, that might be something to bring to the table actually down the line so that maybe we can act on or figure out how we might act on these frustrations that we've aired
yeah.
in this episode. I love that. I didn't get a chance to click on that, so that would be great. There were two things I was thinking about for homework. One of the things that Fetterman does in this piece is he mentions some of our early social movements around climate change and environmental infrastructure protection, where when we saw the Keystone XL pipeline, Dakota Access Pipeline, Standing Rock. And so I just want to kind of go back and refamiliarize myself with what took place during those movements, what lessons were learned from those movements, because it's just been some time. The other thing I want to do is, as you mentioned, this was the, what do you call it, the centerpiece, the cornerstone
cover
story.
Article.
That's the word
cover
in
story,
journalism.
Yeah.
The cover story of the May issue of In These Times magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And this one was so good. And I'm sure there's so much more in the way of great analysis in this issue about the war on protests and social movements that's happening right now. And so I want to see if there's more things we can bring to the table from this May issue.
Sounds great.
Yes.
That's good homework. All right. Well, Damien, you're up next time. What do you bring to the table in our next episode?
Yeah, so I'm going to bring another piece from the latest edition of Hammer and Hope to the table for us. And that their newest issue, as we've mentioned before, is entirely focused on what's happening in Israel and Palestine. Mm. We read and discussed Derica Purnell's great piece just a few weeks ago. And so now I'm really excited to talk about a piece written by the great Angela Davis called Standing with Palestinians. Yes, look at that. We've got sound effects, folks.
Hey.
I was like, I have to bring this. We have to at some point bring this to the table. I haven't read much of it at all, but it seems to be this reflection on the past 60 years from her perspective. And what better person could we possibly learn from and walk through history beside than Angela Davis, I think. So
yeah.
I'm excited to read this piece and get to talk about it in depth with you next week.
Yeah, I've been wanting to read that one and a lot of the other stuff from Hammer and Hope, this
Absolutely.
Most recent issue. So great, looking forward to that right here next week. With that, we want to thank you for joining us today. You know what I'm going to ask you to do here, but in case you forgot, please follow, leave a rating and review, share a podcast with the people in your life. Follow us on social media, including Instagram and TikTok. Check us out on YouTube. Sign up and join us on Patreon to get notified about any new things we got going on behind the scenes.
Yes, thank you for listening. And remember, it's not about us, but it is about all of us. And we'll talk to you next week.